Welcome to another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. Today I'm delighted to be talking with Yahya Emmerich, the vice principal of a full-time Islamic parochial school in Westbury, New York. Mr. Emmerich is also the author of 25 books for adults and children, including The Complete Idiot's Guide to Rumi Meditations and The Complete Idiot's Guide to Understanding Islam. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, from your biography, it appears that besides being a devoted follower of Islam, you also have written many textbooks for the people of your faith. So can you talk about what kind of preparation is required to write a textbook? You know, what kind of schooling or experience or expertise?
Great. That would be a wonderful question to consider. Usually when people get textbooks, either in a college class or in an elementary school, if you look in the front, there's usually five, even up to 10 authors' names.
Mm.
So, you know, it's a pretty daunting task for a single individual to do. Myself, I got interested in that kind of writing after I had converted to Islam a number of years ago and started teaching in a Muslim school full-time. And I noticed that the materials that we had for the students were very poorly written.
Mm.
A lot of it was imported from other countries. And so I had put it in my mind that, you know, I could probably do much better than this, and it would benefit the students. So luckily, around the same time, I was reading voraciously. And up till that point, I read about 200 books on Islam.
Wow.
So I had been so widely read that when you sit down in front of, well, I guess back then it would have been a typewriter, you know, the ideas just start flowing to your fingers.
So you don't have a PhD. You're kind of a self-taught.
I have a master's degree in education, secondary education.
Wow.
I've been mulling over going for the PhD, but after writing so much for so many years, I'm wondering what I would gain from the piece of paper.
Yeah.
But basically, if you're going to tackle something as big as a textbook project, you have to have been exposed to a large amount of writings on topics that are specific to, you know, what you want to do.
So tell me, you know, when you kind of undertake writing a textbook, what are you trying to accomplish in terms of voice that might be different from what in one of the Complete Idiot's Guide? You know, how are they different from one another?
Well, textbooks are for learning. They're for use in schools. And, you know, if you remember from your own days in any level of school, there is a different tone, like you mentioned. You can't let it be too familiar or story-like at the same time. You can't let it be too technical.
Mm.
You have to strike a medium balance in between, because you're really trying to get the interest of the reader and at the same time teach them some practical knowledge rather than just trying to entertain them.
Got it. Now, do you have any advice for people who want to become textbook authors?
You have to really like the subject, first of all. I know there. I've talked to people in the past who have been involved in different kinds of book projects, and every once in a while you'll come across somebody who they're just doing it for the money. You know, it's a job.
Yeah.
And you know, usually they express some kind of frustration that they're not connecting with the project as well. I would say write textbooks only if you're passionate about the subject, and again, if you're widely read.
Yeah.
It's key, because unless you have your cup overflowing, your fingers will not benefit from those flashes of insight and those ideas that will just come out of nowhere.
Yeah, that's a great thought. Well, now I'm curious about the fact that you've both written for adults and children. So do you want to talk a little bit about the difference between writing for the two audiences?
Well, when you're writing children's books, usually, you know, you're talking about fiction. Kids learn best through stories.
Hmm.
In ancient times, you know, our ancestors would have sat around campfires at night, and the elders would have told the stories of the tribe, and the young cave boys and girls would have been sitting mesmerized in wonder at the legends they were hearing. And, you know, this would make an imprint upon them, and they could pass on the same. So, you know, you're trying to bring a little bit of magic on the printed page. Since you don't have, like, an animated storyteller there in front of them,
mm.
I guess this is what we're competing with television, right?
That's, yeah, absolutely.
So, So if you're talking about children's literature, not textbooks, you got to have a flair for how children see the world.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be exposed to that. And I always say that the best way to do that is to read children's books yourselves. You know, go to the bookstore, you know, just sit there for a while and watch when your target age group of kids come into the bookstore or the library, look at see what books they're picking off the shelves and going and sitting down and reading. And then you go get some of those books and then familiarize yourself with the pattern and, you know, with how the language is used and what kinds of turns of events are happening. And then you get a pretty good idea of what you have to do, too.
Hmm. And have the books you've written for children been mostly fiction or nonfiction or a mix?
Well, besides those textbooky kind of books I've written, all the children's books that I've written have been stories, been fiction, mostly adventure.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Because that's a personal love of mine. I grew up reading all kinds of science fiction and fantasy, and you know, those are some of the best years of my life.
Oh, how fun.
Growing up with one of those books.
Well, now, this new book is about Rumi. Can you talk about who he was, why he's important?
Well, Jalaluddin Rumi, as we call him in the West here, is a famous Muslim poet, so famous, in fact, and so well-read that I've seen the statistic a few places that more books of Rumi poems are sold in English-speaking countries than any other poet.
Wow.
Which was pretty fascinating for me. I actually heard this some years ago. But I wasn't all that surprised because I've been exposed to his poetry, like many Muslims and non-Muslims, for a long time because he was basically the philosopher spiritualist par excellence. And people really find, you know, a message in his poetry that resonates with their own life experience,
mm-hmm.
and also with their own questions that they have about life. As far as who he was born in the year 1207, so we're reaching back into, I guess in Europe it would have been the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
He was born in an area just north of Afghanistan, which was basically the Wild West of the classical Muslim world. You had, you know, bandits roaming the countryside. You had opulent cities on the trading roads. You had mystics and scholars wandering around and ordinary people, you know, just trying to scratch a living out of the hard landscape of Central Asia. And lucky for Rumi, his father was a scholar in the area who had an extensive library. And Islam had only come to this area about 100 years before, maybe 200 years before. So scholars were, you know, in high demand.
Mm.
And so Rumi grew up in this sort of world of books and world of learning and knowledge. It doesn't mean that his childhood was easy. Being where he was located, you know, one of those crossroads of the worlds, there was always the threat of invaders. Coming in from the east, the west, the north, the south. And because of this, his father had to move the family around several times to escape this or that invasion. And the main invaders of the day are going to be, of course, our friends the Mongols, which I'm excited to see that new movie coming out, Mongol, because I think it's a pretty amazing time to live in. Dangerous, but amazing. So along his travels as a youngster, Rumi was getting the best education that a person at that time could expect. Because of his father's connections, he was meeting famous people, which also included many famous mystics. At this time in Muslim history, the mystics were really the celebrities of the day.
Mm.
They were the ones that you would go see. They were the rock stars.
Wow.
So Rumi got to meet many famous ones, including Fariduddin Attar, and Muhyiddin ibn Arabi. These writers, you can find their books in Barnes & Noble today. Along the way, as a young man, Rumi got sent away to Syria for extensive education with scholars and mystics. And after his father passed away, Rumi found himself living in Turkey, in the city of Konya, as a 25, 30-year-old man. And then out of nowhere, a former disciple of his father comes along and reveals to Rumi that his father was not just a scholar, but was a famous mystic himself. And this intrigued Rumi, who was given some writings of his father about mysticism, connecting with your soul, learning to transcend the world. And this set Rumi off on sort of a quest to elevate his inner self and his inner being. And he began writing poems to express what he was thinking about and his ideas. And a curious thing happened one day. While he was on the road going from a college that he was in charge of, the local sultan had given him a job, a stranger pops out of nowhere and asks Rumi a very puzzling question. You know, who was better, Prophet Muhammad or this mystic who lived many centuries before by the name of Bayezid Bustami? And Rumi was like, well, of course, you know, Prophet Muhammad is better. And then this mysterious figure said, but wait a minute. Muhammad said, you know, oh God, I always want more information and spirituality from you, whereas Bayezid said, I am the truth. In other words, like, you know, he already understood everything about spirituality. But he was trying to say to Rumi that, you know, oh, you know, Muhammad was always saying he wanted more spiritual knowledge, but this guy said he's already filled up. And Rumi was really puzzled for a moment, but his logic came to the fore, and he replied back to this strange, bedraggled man. He said, the reason why Bayezid said he's the truth is because he had a limited spiritual capacity, and he already was filled up.
Wow.
Muhammad always asked God for more guidance because he was always thirsty for guidance, and he could never be satiated. And it, according to the story, this figure, this person, he fainted because the logic was just, you know, too much for him. Rumi took him home, learned his name, was Shamsuddin, and he had been a wandering mystic for a long time, and Rumi befriended him. And they had this great friendship. They would spend all their time together. Well, you know, Rumi's students got jealous, and so Shamsuddin was sort of like, you know, he understood that he needs to get away because these students are jealous of me. So he left. And Rumi was so heartbroken that he lost his, like, best friend, that he wrote this whole long series of poems over the course of the next couple of years, that spiritual longing with Shamsuddin as a focus. We call this the Divan. Sometimes you'll see it, the Divan of Shamsuddin at Tabrizi. These are basically these kinds of poems. Well, eventually, this figure comes back. He lives for a couple more years with Rumi, but then Shamsuddin disappears under mysterious circumstances. And nobody knows exactly what happened to him, but Rumi suspects that maybe, you know, one of his sons might have had something to do with it. He was jealous of his father, like, you know, giving all this attention to this stranger from outside. Well, Rumi had to make a choice in his mind. Is he going to go back to lamenting the loss of his friend, or is he going to elevate himself to a new level and realize that it's not a friend on earth, it's not a guide, it's not like a guru who is going to bring you to fulfillment of your spiritual desires? He realized that you have to step above that, and that only God is the one who can provide this missing space in your heart. It's the only one who can fill it. So Rumi begins to start a new project that we call the Mathnawi. This is his, like, his opus, his great work. It was one of his students, a guy by the name of Husamuddin, who went to Rumi one day and, you know, basically said, you know, you're saying such great stuff. Can you please write this stuff down so future generations can study it? And Rumi said, I was already thinking about it. And he pulled a paper out of his hat, and he had the first 18 lines of this monumental work already written. So for the next several years, Rumi would dictate these poems to his top student, Husamuddin, who would write down the poems, and they would go over them and correct them. And, you know, near the end of his life, he completed these six massive volumes of poetry. And basically, when you buy those Rumi books,
yeah.
poems are mostly taken out of there.
Okay.
Now, he was so beloved of people in the area that he used to attract Muslims, Christians, Jews, Zoroastrians, and Hindus, you know, to come and sit in on his lectures.
Mm-hmm.
Because he would speak about the soul, he would speak about love, he would speak about how to give up hate and how to give up this selfish desire to, you know, amass more and more material goods.
Mm-hmm.
Basically how to free your soul, free yourself from the shackles of this life so that you can experience the soaring of your soul even before you die and go into the next life. So one of the things he used to do that people were, like, you know, attracted to, he used to just spin around in circles rhythmically, chanting the names of God and various prayers, you know, that whirling dervish thing.
Yeah.
He actually did not start the ritual that you see today where you have all these guys lined up and they're wearing these fancy dresses and they spin in a very choreographed way. He didn't used to do it that way. It was more spontaneous. Later followers actually put that together. But if you could just imagine somebody that combines the traits of a Gandhi and a John Lennon and a Martin Luther,
yeah.
Just in one person, somebody whose personality is so expansive, whose ideas are so seductive, and whose personal affectation is just so inviting and inebriating. Well, then you can understand, you know, who Rumi was and why people are attracted to his writings even to this day.
Yeah, and one of the things, one of the reasons I wanted to do this interview and was so drawn to your book is that I've been a big Rumi fan for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, have my little essential Rumi sitting next to my chair that I read in the morning, every morning. And so, you know, can you talk a little bit about his modern importance and when that seemed to happen, or if is it relatively recent that people have been attracted to Rumi again, or has there never been a cease in that?
Well, in the Islamic or Muslim world, Rumi's writings have been spread around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
When he finished his book near the end of his life, his like six volume Mathnawi, it was studied by his followers. Copies were made. There are old copies going back, like almost to his time, of this huge work. You can find it in Persia, you can find it in Turkey, you can find copies in the Arab world, even over back in his native Tajikistan and Afghanistan and that region. There are old copies. They were spread around everywhere. Because there was a time up until the era of colonialism, when the Europeans came and basically shut everything down in the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. But there was a time when the Muslim world was a very fluid place. If it didn't matter where you were born, there was no guarantee you were going to stay there. Muslims were like literally the original hippies on the road.
Wow.
It was just like you go out on the road, you travel, you trade. So there was a lot of mixing going on. It was sort of like, you know, how Manhattan in New York is today, or, you know, some of these other places where people mix from all over the world. So if you can imagine that on a large scale, so the books would get around, the mystics were always traveling from this city to that city, scholars were always going everywhere. So Muslims have always been familiar with it. In the West, there are some early translations of parts of Rumi's poems going back to the, you know, 1700s and 1600s, but they never caught on with the general population.
Mm.
This didn't really get popularized until the 1800s, especially as you get later in the 1800s when people in the West became fascinated with, you know, the mysterious East.
Yeah.
You know, this whole Orientalism thing, you know, so a lot of these kinds of images of Alibaba and the 40 Thieves and all these sort of things, you know, they really made a jump in the West, mostly in the 1800s, a little bit in the 1700s. But as far as Rumi's works are concerned, really a lot of the pioneering work was done in the late 1800s.
Mm.
You got works by Nicholson and a couple of reverends. They, you know, they actually went out and they learned Farsi.
Wow.
And because they wanted to translate a lot of this literature, it was the whole Orientalist movement. And you get some of the first complete translations in French and English in the late 1800s. And, you know, they were written in more academic language, but still a lot of people who were exposed to it were finding it interesting. I remember reading not too long ago, there was an interview with, I think it was Coleman Barks. I'm not sure exactly which one. It's escaping me at the moment. But one professor told a popular writer that these poems of Rumi are really beautiful. You have to unchain them, release them from their boxes. You know, the academic language that the translators used originally?
Yeah.
You know, it wouldn't be something that the general population would just grab onto. So if you took them and put them in more accessible language, it's sort of like, you know, nobody wants to read William Shakespeare in the original today,
mm-hmm.
but you'll read those versions that are in modern English.
Yep.
So from the 1950s and 60s onward, you had an explosion of various people mining these older translations and just updating the language so that the beauty of the poem could come through without the difficulty of the, you know, the harder grammar and the older conventions. So really, really from the 60s and 70s onward, you're getting this explosion of Rumi books. But it seems to me, I'm a frequent visitor in bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the main heyday seems to have been in the 90s.
Okay.
Where you got an explosion. You might have noticed that too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was in the 90s that Rumi just kind of came to the forefront, and I come out of a Christian tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And so suddenly I was noticing that people who wrote kind of popular spiritual nonfiction in our tradition were quoting Rumi,
mm-hmm.
when I'd never seen it before. So,
it was like, where's this guy coming from?
Well, yeah, what happened? And then it was everywhere, and it was, you know, writers were quoting him, and a number of people in the life coaching movement follow his teachings and talk about
it. You know what's really
him.
Amazing is that, okay, Rumi's writings are very deep, very, very intense. They provoke a lot of thought.
Mm.
In the Muslim world, from approximately the years around 900 to about 1400, you had a lot of writers doing this sort of thing.
Mm.
Rumi himself had a whole library of books written by different kinds of mystics that influenced him.
Wow.
And we know which books those are, and most of them have survived. And you find some of those in the bookstores now, too. Like, for example, he was heavily influenced by Fariduddin Attar, who wrote a book called The Conference of Birds.
Mm.
And there's a very good translation available by Dick Davis and something off Takbawi or something like that. I have it on my bookshelf over here somewhere. But very good translation. And this particular book is the story of a group of birds who want to go on a journey to find their king because they feel an emptiness inside,
mm.
and they think having a king will fulfill it. And so they choose a particularly wise bird to be their guide. And this bird realizes that the emptiness in this whole crowd is not because they don't have a king, but it's something deeper.
Mm.
And along this journey, he tries to make them understand this through all these wisdom stories and teaching stories and things to consider and discuss. So that's just one example. Rumi's father, Bahauddin, he wrote his own book too.
Wow.
The whole idea is to get in touch with your spirituality inside. So it's like, you know, people get surprised when they realize that, well, the Muslim world produced more than just Rumi.
Yeah,
produced a lot of people. You know, it's like in the same way you go into Barnes & Noble today or Borders Books, and there's just bookshelves lined everywhere with spiritual titles.
Yeah.
You know, self-help books and everything else. Hey, this is a long tradition in human history.
It is, and I think that's, you know, that's so interesting that Rumi feels very contemporary. I know when some of Aristotle's work I'll read, and I'll think, you know, this is kind of like Cosmopolitan. He's got some good suggestions here.
Yeah, I personally like some of the Roman writers, like you know, Seneca or Cicero.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you, one of the things I noticed about the book is that it's very interactive. You have questions and suggestions for integrating this into people's lives. So what tips do you have for creating interesting and helpful questions and activities as a writer?
Well, as a writer, one thing you want to make sure of is that you don't want to lose your audience. And that, I guess, goes for anything. You know, and if you really want to know how to grab people, ask yourself, what grabs me? You know, what do I like in a book? What draws me in? What can make a book useful for me? And chances are it's probably pretty close to what would get anybody else. So go around in a bookstore or a library, and, you know, if you have in your mind a certain kind of book that you want to write, go look and see what other people have done.
Yeah.
You know, you go and compare, and what do you think works in this book, and what works in that book, and the approach in this book, what doesn't work over there? And then you want to avoid those things. So really, it's just, you know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, we all work with each other as writers, and we all live off of each other, you know, mentally, so to speak. So, you know, as far as the Idiot's Guide is concerned, you know, it's part of a whole series of books on every topic imaginable. I was in the grocery store the other day, and I saw The Complete Idiot's Guide to Making Your Relationships Work. I was like, whoa, they got one on everything. So, you know, this company, Alpha, has done their research into how best to make books useful.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they gave me also guidelines
of
what they wanted me to do and how they wanted me to do it. And I remember the first book I wrote for the Idiot's Guide, it's a Complete Idiot's Guide to Understanding Islam. I'd never written a book like that before. So when they first were contacting me, I went out and I got a bunch of Idiot's Guides on different topics just so I could familiarize myself with the approach. And so basically, if you want to make the book interesting for people and useful, take the roadmap that's given to you, or go out and find it.
That's helpful. Thank you. I'm. You know, we have time for like one final writing tip. So, you know, as a writer of 25 books, do you have a final tip you'd like to leave with our listeners?
What I would suggest is the person who loves reading and makes time, not necessarily daily, but, you know, maybe a few times a week, the person who makes time to read will be more apt to have passion when you're writing for others. Because you can't do something in a vacuum. You can't do something that you yourself don't want to do. So I'm not going to write, you know, a book here and, you know, and think to myself, well, I'm never going to read a book myself. So if you are keeping yourself in the loop of reading, then you keep yourself familiar with exactly how you should write. This is my audience. I know my audience because I am part of the audience. So my tip would be to make sure you keep reading yourself. It helps in so many ways, and it gives inspiration, like I said before, to your fingertips when you're typing and suddenly ideas come to you out of nowhere and you're like, wow, where did that come from? It came from your subconscious, from your mind that you let overflow with books on any topic that interests you. Read.
Thank you so much. I love that tip. I'm a big reader, and I want others to be big readers, so thank you so much. And thanks for this great interview. It was wonderful to have you with us.
It was my pleasure.
This has been another edition of Always Write with Rochelle, the Write Now Coach. You can find a link to The Complete Idiot's Guide to Rumi at my website, writenowcoach.com. Thanks for tuning in, and remember to always write.